A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Thea Lynn Arbutian, editor at the TLS, and Lucy Dallas, our arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Thea. How's it going?
I am well, thank you. How are you?
All right, thank you. Yeah, fine. I'm looking forward to what you're about to announce.
Yes. Okay, yes. Because hopefully all our listeners will recall that we ended last week's discussion of Edna St. Vincent Millay with a surprise call out for any exceptionally good poems about dinosaurs. So A.E. Stolling said that she couldn't think of any, but was of course more than happy to be corrected. Well, we knew that our listeners would not disappoint us. So Kauri Tulinius wrote in almost as soon as the episode went out to point out to us that Edwin Morgan has this wonderful poem called The Loch Ness Monster's Song. And just to give you a taste of that strange, gruffling beast of a poem, I'm definitely not brave enough to read the whole thing. But
I was just going to suggest that you perform the whole thing.
Oh, no. I mean, if you'd like to, Lucy, be my guest.
No, if you could do the opening and I'll do the middle line, which is what gives it all away, I think.
Okay. So, well, the first line is smwaffle.
Very good. And then it goes on like that for a bit with a little grub dob blub 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 blub. And then in the middle, it's hoverplodoc doplodovoc plovodocot doplodocot.
Very good. Very good. Also, because it's a question, isn't it?
It is a question.
It's a question.
Which gives you a little bit of a clue.
It does.
And the end, clearly she's going back under because it goes
yeah. blub, blub. I know, blub, the blub, final blub, line. Blub. So good. Blub.
And if you go to the Poetry Archive page with it on, Edwin Morgan is performing it. That's how we know
exactly
sort of how it goes, because we've heard it from the man himself. It's really wonderful. It does say it's a song. I wonder if it's ever been set to music. That would be
something. Come on, listeners, bring your talents together, dinosaur yeah. poems and musical compositions. But yes, yeah, so, I mean, at the heart of that is the question, is the monster a dinosaur? I put this to Alicia, mm-hmm. and she absolutely agrees on the poem's sui generis greatness and concedes that it might well be in the running. So I'm not sure how much longer this challenge has left to run, but if there are any more dinosaur poems, well, correction, if there are any
great
more great
dinosaur poems
yeah. out there, yeah. please do send them in, set to music, preferably, but not essential, that last bit. But now, coming up on this week's show. We have heard the Rothschild story told before, how a humble Jewish family rose from the Frankfurt ghetto of the late 1700s to a position of spectacular wealth, influence and notoriety as Europe's premier banking dynasty. Now, let's hear that story again, this time with the women put back in. The historian Abigail Green will tell us more. But first, Lucy, you're going to take us somewhere quite unsettling.
Yes, indeed. We're going to go from vampires, fairies and sea monsters to Carnies and the House of Damnation. The filmmaker Guillermo del Toro has conjured up dark, fantastical visions for us before, and now here's another one. Nightmare Alley, his new offering, is out now, and we are very glad that Muriel Zaga wrote about it for us, and she joins us today to talk it through. Muriel, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
You start your piece by pointing out what is not present in this film, which might be a bit surprising. Can you enlighten us about that?
Yes, so those familiar with del Toro's oeuvre will know that he is drawn to the fantastical, the gothic. There are often ghosts and fairies and dreams and hauntings and sea monsters in his films. In this one, there are no supernatural elements. Whatever supernatural elements there are fake. So there is a character who pretends to be a clairvoyant and to be able to read minds and communicate with ghosts, but it is actually, he's only a grifter. What there is tremendous uncanny energy that is generated by the immersive universe of the carnival, of the neo-noir world of treachery, conspiracy, psychoanalysis, double crossing, and human behavior that is always trying to push the boundaries.
Well, it's funny that del Toro can find, well, I mean, of course, he can find just as much darkness there as in anything made up.
Well, it could happen to you. That's the point.
I do hope not, Muriel, from what you said. But okay. it's not a new story, is it, Nightmare Alley? Can you tell us kind of where it came from and roughly what the plot outline is?
Right. So the source of it is a novel, a 1946 novel by an author called William Lindsay Gresham. And the novel is pretty much the source for the film, although there was a previous film, a previous adaptation in very soon after publication in the late 40s. There's a movie by Edmund Golding starring Tyrone Power, which is not a neo-noir, but an original noir. So the story of the novel, which is then exploited in the two films, is about a drifter, stroke grifter who, having lost everything, his past is very shady. We don't really know where he came from. He drifts into the world of the carnival, joins a traveling carnival, joins a clairvoyant act, and then goes on to greater or worse things by becoming an arch manipulator of his own. And really, the story is about the underbelly of 1930s, 1940s America. So the darker, the underside of a lighter world of, a lighter world of all American heroes. There are no heroes in this world. Everybody is an anti-hero. And the Stanton Carlyle, the anti-hero of this story, which who is played by Bradley Cooper in the del Toro version, this version, he is a sort of, really, he's a spider who is fine until weaving his web, until he meets a snake, and then that's the end of him. So it's really about the darkest workings of the human psyche.
And it is, as you kind of put your finger on there, it is a very American film, isn't it? I mean, not just in terms of the setting, but the main character, played by Bradley Cooper, as you said, he seems like this dark version of the self-made man, you know, the American dream, and I suppose that's precisely what a successful con man is.
Exactly so. So it's the way that you can reinvent yourself entirely. So walk away because of the vastness of the country, partly to do with space. You're able to literally incinerate your previous life, which is what he does in the opening sequence, and then get on a Greyhound bus and travel the length of the country and alight somewhere else and start again, afresh, reinvent yourself entirely as a new version of yourself without any consequences, or so he thinks.
Mm. I like the way that you contrasted it with The Great Showman, which is, you know, which is all about, this is actually a wonderful community of people, you know, expressing themselves and building a community. And this is quite the opposite, isn't it?
It would actually also make a good musical, I think, Nightmare Alley. I can imagine that this could be a new incarnation of it, would be one with songs, because it wants to sing in many ways. But yes, the carnival attractions, there's a contortionist who's a snake man, there's a spider woman, there's an electric girl whose act consists of pretending to electrocute herself on the electric chair. Where the Greatest Showman is really all about inclusivity, isn't it? Through performance, instead of being purely an object of ridicule and entertainment, the performers in the Greatest Showman achieve visibility. They are able to be themselves, to express their own individuality, their difference, all of that. This, I suppose, winds back to a time before we developed such ideas, where the freaks are simply freaks. So it's not perhaps as unflinching as Todd Browning's movie Freaks, a 1930s movie, which I think is one of the intertexts for Del Toro, because he loves that movie, which is in a sense, a bit of a film noir also, because there's deceit and conspiracy and revenge in it. But in Freaks, the real freaks are not the carnival performers who perform their own physical disabilities. The freaks are the superficially pleasing non-disabled people. And in a sense, in Del Toro's world, it is a bit like that, because it's the anti-hero and then the femme fatale he meets later on, who is played by Cate Blanchett, who are physically, superficially quite pleasing. You know, they are Hollywood movie stars and they are sort of abnormally good looking, but they are the most depraved and dehumanized of all.
Mm. I was going to ask about the cast. It's a very star-studded cast. You say that Cate Blanchett is channeling Lauren Bacall just on the right side of pastiche. It reminded me of, she kind of does that with Katharine Hepburn, I think, in The Aviator, doesn't she?
Yes. Well, she has that sort of, this was physically being tall and quite angular, very imposing, charismatic, the sort of angular face. She has the sort of screen presence that these actresses had. But of course, but she's very versatile. You know, I saw her fairly recently in the Woody Allen movie, Blue Jasmine, where she plays a woman on the verge of she's really gone over to the other side. It's a kind of study in delusion. But she has a period face, doesn't she? So she's very good at Carol also, because she can look like a 1950s beauty. So in this, I mean, Lauren Bacall, that's my own reading, because I was very struck by the resemblance, especially in those beautifully tailored black 1930s dresses that she wears. But there's something incredibly sultry and languid about her, but also steely. And the voice, that sort of very deep voice of the psychoanalyst, because she is an analyst in the film. Mm. She's called Lilith as well. I mean, all the good things are there. But I get the impression that it must have been a lot of fun for her to compose the character and to channel certain noirish energies very knowingly. So she knows that she's playing this sort of evil, manipulative woman, but it's done in a fantastically humorous way. In spite of the darkness of the material, it is fun.
And I was surprised to read that you said that that Bradley Cooper has got a very strong connection with the David Lynch film of The Elephant Man.
That's a surprise, isn't it? Because it's always interesting to read up on Hollywood stars. They often have dark recesses. And if it hadn't been for the Del Toro, it was actually a collaboration. I think Del Toro and Bradley Cooper really hit it off and collaborated on the script together quite closely. And that's partly because Cooper had always wanted to be in such a part of such a project, because where Del Toro's first cinematic emotion came when he saw Frankenstein, when he was 6 years old, he saw James Whale as Frankenstein, and that made an impression on him that probably marked him for life. Bradley Cooper was marked at quite a young age also by David Lynch's Elephant Man. And that was the movie that made him want to be an actor. You know, not seeing, I don't know, Cary Grant or Tony Curtis, but seeing the performance of John Hurt in Elephant Man. And then fairly recently, a few years ago, he achieved his dream of playing the part himself on Broadway. So that does add an interesting layer to his persona, because he is, again, you know, very good-looking, clean-cut sort of actor.
Very kind of plausible and handsome and looks very sort of... Yes, I suppose so. But he is actually very good at playing, for want of a better word, baddies.
Yeah, I think that's where he shines, is because he has this sort of sunny... That there's a lot of, he's very blue-eyed and smiley, and there's a sort of radiance about him. And so what better cover, really, for appalling manipulativeness, which is what he... And because of the character being so unmoored, because he is a drifter and doesn't appear to have any moral compass whatsoever, then he's very well equipped with his good looks. And in one of the early scenes, the character of the clairvoyant, who's played by Toni Collette, says to him, "You'll go far because you're easy on the eyes," you know, and that is what he has going for him. So it is interesting there too, that the in a way the sort of erotic focus is on the man, is on the male lead more than on the women.
He does play very well with that whole the way that he looks and the way that we expect him to be as a Hollywood actor. I was just talking to Lucy before we came on to do this about Licorice Pizza, the Paul Thomas Anderson film, and Bradley Cooper has a cameo in that. Have you seen it?
Not yet, but I saw him in the trailer.
Yeah, and it's brilliant, because it's that thing of his projection, his image is of this pretty Hollywood guy. And then he blows out of the water. It's very playful. I really recommend that film as well. But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about. I'm talking about this film first. I will contain myself. I wanted to ask you about the period in which it's set, how conscious the film is of the period in which it's set, because you mentioned some echoes of the First World War, and I found that quite intriguing.
Yes, I think so. The original novel and the first film adaptation are both late 40s, so post Second World War. In this, the impression I received from the plot is that when we begin the story, it's still late 30s, it's pre-war, pre-Second World War, I should say. And then by the end, by the time that he's achieved, you know, he's become a big sort of nightclub clairvoyant act, then America has just joined the war, is about to join the war. So it spans that arc. And some of the people who come to the fairground in the first place, and then the people he manipulates in the nightclubs where he works later on, are people who have lost sons in the Great War, in the previous war. And so a lot of the story hinges on the ethics or otherwise of using a clairvoyant act for what's called a spook show. That's to say, to make people believe that you can communicate with ghosts, that you can help them get in touch with their dead. And the dead in this case, in this movie, are not exclusively, but in one very important case, a young man who died in the trenches, whose parents are desperate to communicate with him. And I was struck by that, because I think that's probably an addition. I can't swear to it because I haven't read the novel, but it's certainly not in the original, in the first film adaptation. And that, I think, is where Del Toro reconnects with his own take on history, which is always a little bit phantasmagoric, while being rooted in real events. So previous films like Pan's Labyrinth or The Devil's Backbone, for example, which are Spanish language movies that he made earlier in his career, are set against the backdrop of the Spanish Civil War and the horrors of that. And here, although the Great War is not happening while the action is unfolding, it has happened and is still very much present in people's memories. And so when there is violence, because at some point violence really erupts and there are a couple of really gruesome murders, which, again, it's all about balance. They border on Grand Guignol, but it's not quite Grand Guignol because of the context, because the emotional context is there. And because you've had this idea of the spook show and of summoning the dead of the Great War, when there is butchering of human lives, that is what you think of. And I thought that was done very well, because it is oblique, it's not explicit, but I'm certain that it's there. I'm certain that it's woven into it because of his interest in sort of a kind of palimpsest, really, of history and fantasy, where one illuminates the other.
Mm. And you say that also that the film is, it's a brilliant phrase, I think, that it's visually plotted and fully expressive of classic noir fatalism. Does the, because the visuals are so strong in his work. I mean, of course, that's important for a film. Of course it is. But does it dominate or overpower everything else, or is it a balance?
I mean, it's incredibly gorgeous. The production is by a woman called Tamara Devereaux, I think, and the quality of the work is remarkable. And obviously, the budget must have been significant, because the carnival, for example, was really built as a carnival. So I think they could conceivably have charged entry, you know, and people could have gone in and gone on the rides and gone into the amazing sort of machinery of attractions. It's very luscious and very beautiful to look at. There is also that element of neo-noir, that's to say, you know, in a noir film made in the 1940s, a character goes into a lift, they just go into the lift and then out of the lift. Whereas when it's something that's made much later by people who love the period and are delighted to be traveling back into it, we will see how beautiful this Art Deco lift is, and there'll be lots of lingering shots of the corridors and the surfaces and the furniture and the architecture, interiors, exteriors. It's all incredibly beautiful. It does perhaps drag on a little. I mean, there is certainly a fetishistic element there, which is also present, for example, in some of the Coen Brothers movies that are set in the same time period, because of the same adoration of the period. You can't really get enough of the colors and the, you know, for example, but although it does drag on a bit at times, it is very immersive. If you like the period, you will love it. And sometimes it's the attention to detail that does it. For example, there's a scene early on at the carnival where a crowd is watching one of the attractions on one of the stages. And you see a few children are holding up balloons, and the balloons are in, I'm sure, entirely correct, historically correct shades of orange and red. And the colors are so true that they're almost like notes of music. You know, there's something so vivid and piercing about it that I think overall it is a wonderful experience, but you can't help noticing that there's something very self-conscious about it necessarily.
Right. But you think it earns the time.
I'm very happy to have given 2.5 hours of my life to this film. Okay. Not always
That's
true.
That's a great endorsement.
It is. I was going to ask you about Del Toro. He's apparently close friends with Alfonso Cuarón and Alejandro Iñárritu as well. They seem to be called, I'm not sure if they call themselves or if Hollywood has called them the Three Amigos, so I'm not sure if that's a... okay to
hope
say
they call
that
themselves
not.
It.
I hope so too.
I did wonder about that. I think it's probably one of those things that was coined by someone else and then they sort of reclaimed it. You know, you would, wouldn't you? Because
yeah.
There is
so.
Certainly a really interesting sort of Mexican auteurs, Mexican filmmakers alliance there, where they watch each other's work, support each other, and also beyond that trio, Pedro Almodovar was also very instrumental in helping Del Toro, in helping him negotiate his return to Hollywood, actually, because there was an initial experience with Hollywood with Miramax, a movie called Mimic with Myra Sorvino, which was a dreadful experience. It also coincided with, horribly, the kidnapping of Del Toro's father. So... Mm. A really appalling time. And that was, he thought, probably the end of his involvement with a big production company like that in Hollywood. But Almodovar intervened and helped him financially, but also supported him in getting back and somehow finding ways of reclaiming Hollywood as an auteur, which is not easy to do.
I read that he'd been asked to direct The Hobbit, and then there were some problems that made it drag on. So he didn't in the end, but he wrote... Yeah, I couldn't help thinking what those Hobbit films would have been like if Del Toro had done them. They'd be scarier, I think, maybe.
I think so. I think they'd be more intense and visceral, because he's a very visceral director. Fun fact, the wife of the writer, William Gresham, who wrote the novel Nightmare Alley, Joyce Gresham, later went on to marry C.S. Lewis.
Oh, that was his American wife?
Yeah. And which is extraordinary. And so I know this is not The Hobbit, it's a different sort of world of fantasy, but that meant then that Del Toro, who is very geeky about these things, looked into C.S. Lewis and was very interested in the world of C.S. Lewis because of the fantasy element. And then he went off him because he thought he was too religious. Because Del Toro, I mean, that's a whole other thing. And it is woven into Nightmare Alley, the Catholicism, which is Del Toro's, what he bathed in when he was growing up as a child. Mm. But I think he would probably say, like Buñuel, I'm an atheist, thank God. You know, he's one of those people who rejects organized religion, who rejects authority, generally, which is understandable when you look at 20th century history, you know, but who remains shaped by Catholicism. And so what he's achieved in his own world vision is this sort of, I don't know, a sort of heightening or personalizing of Catholicism through fairy tales.
Did you say she was called Joy?
Joyce, I think.
Joyce. Oh, because C.S. Lewis wrote that book called Surprised by Joy, which was about his meeting this woman who was Catholic and who changed his life and reinvigorated him in so many ways. So I'm guessing that's her, Surprised by Joy.
Yeah. I mean, should we check whether her name is Joyce or Joy?
Due diligence.
Yes, she was a poet, wasn't she?
There we go, yeah.
Joy. Right. Looks like
a poet and a child prodigy. So really probably quite an interesting, intense woman. Mm. Another detour.
There's something very, very Del Toro about this whole labyrinthine maze-like structure that we're working our way through.
You quote Del Toro as saying that he, like Hitchcock, only ever makes one film. Mm. Interesting that he chooses Hitchcock as an example. It's a bit like going, like Homer, I like to write long poems. I mean, it's not quite like that, but you know what I mean. Do you buy that he only ever makes one film? And if so, what do you think are the elements of the one film that he's making over and over again?
Hmm. Well, I mean, in a way, it's a defensive argument, isn't it? It's because probably looking at his output, people will have said, you started out doing these independent Spanish language movies that were artier, and then you got sucked into the Hollywood machine and you started making films like Blade and Hellboy and Pacific Rim, which are all huge productions about superheroes and supernatural horror movies. And he would argue that they are all one thing. And I think there is an argument for that, because you get the sense that he is driving his films, that he is in control. He's now, of course, famous enough and successful enough to have that control, which is not given to everybody. But if there is a sort of common thread, and that's where Nightmare Alley is continuous with the rest, even though it doesn't have the supernatural quality of everything that came before, it's, I suppose, the idea of fairy tale curse, the monster, the figure of the monster, who is also a sort of martyr, which again takes us back to religion and the kind of Catholic intertext, perhaps, although it's much transmogrified by a strong Gothic imagination. But there is something, maybe the Gothic, I mean, the Gothic is not a bad way to put it, that there's something powerfully Gothic about everything he does. And I suspect that even if he were to make a documentary about the most mundane things, it would come out looking incredibly weird. So I do think he has a point there. In terms of measuring himself against Hitchcock, you don't really get anywhere in Hollywood without having a huge ego. So.
I think it's fine. He's an artist. Yeah. I mean,
And why not? You know, why not pick someone like that? And again, Hitchcock is interesting because arguably he's only really made one film over and over again. I mean, it's one way of looking at it's all about being an auteur, I suppose, and having these obsessive sort of preoccupations that change shape but remain essentially continuous with one another, so that you're hammering at the same nail. It's interesting.
Oh, well, if you want to go to the cinema and be horrified and unsettled and yet find it all beautiful, yeah. It sounds like Nightmare Alley is a good one to go to. Muriel, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Still to come on the show, the Rothschild women re-enter the story of their own family via a comprehensive and illuminating new book. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. Now, there is no shortage of histories of how the Rothschild family rose from the Frankfurt ghetto to become Europe's premier banking dynasty. The books all tend to take the same approach, though. They'll mention Maya Amschel's wife, Gutler, who, born in 1753, lived almost 100 years, so long enough to see her family progress to that extravagant wealth and influence. But no account that our reviewer Abigail Green has read has got beneath Gutler's skin in the way that Natalie Livingston does in her new book, The Women of Rothschild, which sets out to tell the untold story of the dynasty. Here now to tell us more is Abigail Green. Hello,
hi,
Abigail.
Hi, pleased to be here.
Lovely to have you. You didn't embark on this commission expecting it to impress you, really, did you?
No, I mean, I wasn't sure what to expect of it, but it's a very beautiful book, and it's got, the whole thing is threaded through with a kind of pale blue ink and little butterflies, and I don't know, somehow it just didn't look like the kind of book that could actually be serious. It was too kind of nice and unchallenging, but I was very pleasantly surprised by it.
And one of the reasons for that surprise is, as I suggested in that brief introduction, that Gutler at last emerges as a person more than just a trope in the story.
Yeah, I mean, I have seen some of the early material related to the Rothschilds, and I know, you know, how little there is actually about the women in particular. So I thought it was rather wonderful the way in which the author was able to bring her to life as a person and really explore her role in the counting house and the making of the Rothschild business to begin with in a way that I hadn't seen done before, but obviously which does reflect the kind of work historians have done on the role of women in those kind of businesses.
I mean, the conventional way of telling the Rothschild story is obviously going to be of a piece with the history itself, isn't it? I mean, it's hardly a surprise, but the Rothschild women were, you say, written out of the family business at an early stage. The attitudes even within the family were pretty typical of the time.
Well, it's clear that they did play an important role. So I think there's probably a disjunct between, you know, what people say about them and the role that they're actually playing, because when the men are away, they're holding the fort. And, for instance, Nathan Rothschild's wife, Hannah, clearly he relied upon her and they took decisions increasingly together to some extent. And he felt that she should be involved in managing the business, even though he didn't want her to be formally responsible or the money to be regarded as hers.
It was all sort of behind the scenes, I suppose. But I mean, she sounds Hannah, I suppose we could call her Hannah the First, but she sounds particularly canny.
One of the things which struck me about the book actually was the way in which the business role of the Rothschild women was much more present in the first couple of generations and then kind of subsided a bit into the background. But definitely Hannah does seem to have taken a very active part in decisions about investments and, you know, how to manage the rise and fall of the stock market and this kind of thing. So she obviously was extremely canny. But unlike, Gutler was very much embedded in the Frankfurt ghetto. She never left it. That's kind of the story about Gutler, which is normally told. I guess because she was comfortable in her Jewish community, whereas Hannah, who married Nathan's wife, Nathan's wife, Hannah Baron Cohen, as she was when she was born, I mean, she became a proper society hostess. So she was called upon to do something different and to operate in a different kind of sphere.
Do you think that they helped more at the beginning? It was a case of kind of all hands on deck. So they didn't have the luxury of saying, oh, well, you know, women must do that and men must do this. They just all had to work as hard as they could. And it was only later on that society started demanding different roles.
Well, I think it's important to understand that to begin with, the home and the office were in the same building. So obviously it's much easier for a Rothschild wife like Gutler to be involved in the counting house. But once you're living in one place and the bank is somewhere else, you have that separation between home and kind of the work sphere, which makes it harder for women to be more actively involved.
There are a great number of Hannahs in the story of the Rothschilds women. Some of them will be more familiar perhaps to British readers. And I suppose Part of their role was in sort of diversifying or extending the reach of the family through marriage, for one thing.
Well, this book focuses on the British branch of the family. So although you do have some foreign Jewish women and foreign Rothschild relatives who marry in, the focus is very much on the British family and obviously then some of the British family who marry into different areas of non-Jewish British society.
There's one Hannah in particular who made a very important marriage. This isn't at all to reduce the women to the people who they married, but it was a very important marriage because it wasn't one that was necessarily condoned by the family, but it did kind of really turbocharge the influence and the kind of the echelons that she came to occupy in society. I'm thinking of Hannah Primrose.
Yeah, so this Hannah married Lord Rosebery, who later became Prime Minister. So obviously she entered an aristocratic family. She wasn't the first Rothschild girl to marry out, but the Rosebereys were, I think, of a higher rank than the earlier spouses. And Lord Rosebery was actually very straightforward in his ambition, that what he wanted was to marry an heiress, win the Derby and become Prime Minister. And certainly Hannah, who was, I think, the greatest heiress of her time, did provide him with the wherewithal to do this, but she was also, I mean, she certainly was devoted to him. She, I think, died quite considerably before he did. And this obviously did connect the Rothschilds to the kind of upper level politically, but I don't know whether I would say that it brought the family into this new sphere, because many of the family were very, I mean, if you think about Ferdinand de Rothschild, for example, he was very close to Edward, Prince of Wales, and Waddesdon operated as a kind of alternative court. So I'm not sure that it was a question of bringing them into new social spheres. But obviously she was operating in a different context as a society hostess.
Mm, more about compounding, I suppose. But I mean, Livingston doesn't just retell these stories. Many of them will be familiar to readers and listeners already. She finds new ones, doesn't she? So could you maybe tell us about Henrietta?
Henrietta, in fact, was not new to me, but I realise she will be new to most people. Henrietta was, to begin with, you have the five brothers who founded branches in different parts of Europe. And Henrietta was a sister of those five brothers. And she married Abraham Montefiore. That's how I came across her, who was the brother of Sir Moses Montefiore. And it was a kind of close relationship between the two families, really, because Sir Moses was married to Hannah Baron Cohen's sister, Judith. But Henrietta really had, you know, forged her own path, because she hadn't accepted the marriage which her brothers had initially wanted her to have. And she was very determined that, you know, she and Abraham, who had also actually had a slightly difficult past, would, you know, be able to kind of, well, really she wanted them to be integrated in the Rothschild business, and she failed in this, but clearly they did make an awful lot of money as a separate kind of a household and family. But there was a lot of tension in the family as a result, because Nathan's brothers were quite resistant to Abraham and Henrietta and the way in which they were trying to push themselves into the core Rothschild business, because it was a kind of assumption that underlay the business that it was primarily for the five brothers, and brothers-in-law were not to have the same function.
Obviously they didn't take that. And then they had Louisa, their daughter. I think book lovers will probably be especially interested to hear about her and an interesting friendship with Thackeray.
Yeah, I mean, Thackeray was quite sharp about Jews in some of his writing, but he met Louisa on a steamer on the Rhine, and obviously they grew on and they got on and kind of formed a friendship. Although Louisa seems to have been much more kind of retiring and intellectual than some members of the family. And actually, this is something that you often find. I'm trying to think. I have a feeling there are other examples of it, of women who, Rothschild women who were friendly with mildly anti-Semitic English writers. I don't remember which one it was friendly with Matthew Arnold. But
I suppose it would have been quite difficult to find British writers at the time who, not difficult to find them, but a lot of them will have been anti-Semitic, just because those were the times.
Yes, I mean,
there was so much anti-Semitism.
Yeah, I mean, and obviously prejudices about Jews were widespread and actually attached to the Rothschilds themselves, because there was a set of traditional prejudices around Jews, and then there were these prejudices which we think of particularly, which kind of linked the Rothschilds to the rise of a new kind of capitalist order in a way which made them seem very threatening, as if they were wielding a kind of secret power behind the scenes.
Mm. How does Livingston reconstruct these figures? I mean, how does she sort of lift them off the page and make them live in their times? You know, does she mine diaries and letters? How does it all come together?
Well, she writes very well, and that is important. She is using diaries and letters, and she's obviously had, I mean, the Rothschild archive is a brilliant archive, so she's had access to that. But she has obviously, you know, not always used obvious sources. And also, you know, there must be an awful lot of, I mean, as someone who works with sources, I feel she must have gone through, you know, there must be a huge body of material related to all these women. So it's very impressive, actually, the way in which she has managed to kind of whittle it down and cover it all in a way that makes sense. And what I mean, as a scholar, when you read this kind of book, which is really aiming at targeting the general reader, what you want to see are kind of sentences which make you think, oh, I know what she's talking about, which kind of hint at a kind of much deeper understanding of the issues and a kind of broader range of reading than is actually present in the text. And I thought she did that brilliantly, actually. I mean, I was very impressed by it.
It sounds as though there's a deep scholarly underpinning with some kind of butterflies and some blue ink on top.
Yeah, I was very... So I was surprised by that because, you know, the butterflies and blue ink had you know, I felt it would be a different kind of book, the kind of book my grandmother used to read. But in fact, it did have a proper scholarly underpinning. And it was, I particularly liked the way, in fact, it's actually very cleverly framed by Miriam de Rothschild, who, so it kind of opens with her, the way in which she, as someone writing in the late 20th century, influenced by feminine, looked back on the Rothschild women. And it ends with her and her daughter, Rosie, who was, in fact, a very important feminist, and also someone who was a psychologist, I think. She was a psychologist and an art historian, I think. So very interested in mother-daughter relationships. So it was kind of framed by the way in which these two late 20th century figures had themselves kind of reflected on the kind of relationships and people who were present in the book in a way which I thought was really clever.
Mm, because you mentioned an earlier essay by Miriam Rothschild, published in the 90s, I think, which sort of, as you suggest, sort of lay the foundation stone for precisely this kind of excavation.
Yeah, I must admit, I've not read the essay, but from the bits which were quoted in the book, it did seem to be the case that it had taken a kind of feminist view of these women as being kind of submerged cogs whose role was not properly accounted for or thought about.
Mm. And Rosie Parker, who is Miriam's daughter, she's a really interesting character, very impressive story. And that it sort of makes up for all of the kind of the glossing over of the strengths of these women, to hear her story and what she went on to do.
Yeah, I mean, she was a kind of the arts editor at Spare Rib, and later went on to become one of the founders of feminist art history. So she was a very interesting character. But I thought there was something else there, which I didn't actually write about in the review. But I mean, Constance Battersea, who does feature in the review, who was a kind of very important early 20th century feminist who was influential in founding the British Jewish women's movement as a thing. And Rosie Parker then actually produced, you know, she conducted a kind of interviews with Jewish feminists about anti-Semitism and feminism in a way that we would now understand as being really an exploration of intersectionality. Published it in the Spare Rib as this article called, about anti-Semitism and feminism. I forget exactly what it was called. But what I thought was so striking, and it does tell us something I think important, is the fact that you've got Rothschild women at the beginning and the end of the century playing such a leading role in the British Jewish feminist movement. I mean, I think this is very unexpected and not something we've really reflected upon much, and something perhaps British Jewish feminists would be quite surprised to think about.
Mm. Do you think there are any shortcomings in this book? I got the sense that you weren't particularly satisfied with the treatment of anti-Semitism, for example. I know we touched on that briefly, but I wonder what you thought could have been done differently.
Well, I think the thing is that these women, obviously, particularly in the 20th century, they seem to be leading quite comfortable lives, which you'd expect. They're lives of privilege. You know, these are wealthy people. They're aware of the anti-Semitism and the Holocaust and the persecution which Jews are experiencing on the continent. But it's something which in the book appears to be something which is happening to other people. But anti-Semitism was actually, you know, as indeed you know, I mean, the fact that Rosie Parker can, you know, wanted to think about feminism and anti-Semitism suggests that she was very aware of it as a thing. But it's hard not to feel that once the Jews are emancipated and the Rothschilds have entered Parliament and the House of Lords and all the rest of it, actually everything is hunky-dory, you know, for Jews in 20th century Britain. And I think it really wasn't like that. So in that sense, I mean, this is really a story, you know, a book about the Rothschild women. It's not a book about, it's very much aware of the context in which they're operating, but it's not really addressing that head on. And I guess this focus on personal lives makes it hard perhaps to address those issues. So I did feel that was lacking, yes.
Mm. You see them really come to the fore in the politics, you know, step out of that private lives kind of narrative and engage in politics directly, as in the story of the Balfour Declaration. She shed some new light. Livingstone shed some new light on that matter, doesn't she?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I think this is not exactly new light, because if you were to look, for example, at probably the Wadston website, or you know, you would find material about Dorothy de Rothschild and the Balfour Declaration. But the books I've read about, you know, this kind of material is not well integrated by scholars who are writing about it. So if you read books about the Balfour Declaration, they focus very much on Chaim Weizmann and his wooing of the British establishment and the British Jewish establishment. And the women are not present in that way. I mean, plainly, he was wooing the women, and this was actually rather important. And so, you know, and I thought this was actually very deftly handled by Natalie Livingstone, the way in which she talked not just about how important the women were in generating the Balfour Declaration, but the way in which they were then written out of the narrative almost immediately, so that it was no longer, so that their role was forgotten.
And so what was it
kind of operated at two levels, the way in which she dealt with it, which was, I thought, very clever.
And what is it that she says precisely that they did? How were they involved?
They were the people who really got the male Rothschilds interested in it. So that's very important. You know, in fact, it was Dorothy de Rothschild who Chaim Weizmann first convinced, and then she spoke to Rosika, and you know, they kind of got up. They were the people who acted as, in fact, as kind of mediators between Weizmann and the people who would take the decisions, and the Rothschilds who would then agree to be the addressee of the Balfour Declaration. And they also, I mean, you know, they also had to teach Weizmann how to operate in polite society in a way that he wasn't necessarily very good at doing. So they kind of trained him in social skills. They acted as salonnière, which is a very traditional role, actually, for women. But it's important, I think, that it was still necessary at that point. Mm. This was just about kind of male political movements and cabinet politicians.
Mm. It's a kind of a bit of a Pygmalion story. Before we let you go, then, you're leading a project on Jewish country houses at the moment in partnership with the National Trust. Presumably, you've spent many hours wandering around the tens of Rothschild homes and others. What can you tell us about your work there?
I have visited two in this country and one in France. And I suppose what we try and do is to understand these houses, the people who lived it. So the house is a domestic space, so it's for men and women. And we try to think of these houses as being important for Jewish history in a way that they often don't get understood as being, because we think of modern Jewish history as happening in towns and being about ghettos and different kinds of less aristocratic contexts. But we also work with heritage organisations to help them think about the Jewish dimensions of these houses and the stories they're telling, because the way in which country houses are conventionally presented doesn't necessarily work very well for houses which are telling Jewish stories, or which are not telling stories about landed aristocrats whose family have been in the same house for generation after generation. I mean, so the two Rothschild houses in the Trust are Ascot, which is amazing and not very visited, and Wadston, which is extremely visited, also amazing. And in different ways, they speak to continental stories as well as the British past. So Waddesdon is in a kind of neo-French style, and Ferdinand de Rothschild, who built it, was actually Austrian. So he was a member of parliament. He was a liberal MP, but he had a very heavy German accent, in fact, which may have been one of the reasons, you know, this German context could have helped in his friendship with Edward, Prince of Wales, who became Edward the Seventh. And Ascot, I mean, in terms of the Rothschild myth, actually, Ascot is very interesting because it has got, you know, paintings which depict the kind of famous story about how the Rothschilds made their money. And Henrietta is the only girl who appears alongside the kind of brothers and other protagonists in the story. So I thought of that when I read this book. And it's, you know, it's connected to other families like the Caen d'Anvers, who had houses in France. So we use it also to think, to help people think about the houses as being European houses as well as British houses.
That's fascinating. Well, Abigail Green, many thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Is all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Abigail Green and Muriel Zaga. Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Sophia Franklin. We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.